Hello, community grief leaders. This is Bill Hogan welcoming you to the edition following Sunday, January 27th. Hope your groups are going well and hope you're having some fun while you're doing the facilitating of these groups. Thanks again for all your efforts up front. I don't know if I can say that enough. I have just a couple of administrative items and then some lesson items, so let's just jump right into it. The first administrative item is we would love to have more pictures from groups. And this will come out in the community group newsletter as well, but just in case you don't get a chance to read it, we're looking not just for more pictures, but pictures that reflect our values and our life marks and the joy that is supposed to permeate WordServe as Christ lives in us. The reason that we're doing this primarily is we send out a lot of advertisement material, and when we do that, we're always finding stock photos to put in there because it reflects our values well. That tells me one of two things. Either WordServe is not actually producing joyful servants and we don't have any fun, or we do all that, we just don't capture it on film. I'm guessing it's the latter. So if we can start to capture that on film, then we'll have our people that we can put in with our advertisements, and when people come and visit the church, they'll be able to say, "Hey, I recognize you." It'll be a little more authentic, and it will be a true reflection of who WordServe is. There's more details on how to do that, and I will be sending an attachment via email with some more specific guidelines, but I wanted to let you know why we're asking that. The next little item, I would like you to mark the date, save the date, Saturday, March 23rd, I believe I got that right, for our next leader training. It will be a 1.5-hour session. There will be a doodle poll coming out next week, so I want you to just begin to look at the date, March 23rd, Saturday. All right, enough of the administration. Let's just jump right into the lesson. This will probably go a lot better if you have a copy of the Leader's Guide in front of you, but never fear, even if you don't, we'll still talk through it. A couple of the notes that I want to cover. On one of the questions, I make a note that says, yes, I know that I'm asking the same question over and over, and it basically is, what is the biggest question you have remaining on forgiveness, I think, this week? And I can already hear the critiques. Why are you asking the same question over and over? And my response to that would be, there's nothing wrong with asking the same question over and over. Where you see a problem is if the answer is the same over and over. So if the question is, what are you learning? And the answer is nothing. Or what is your biggest question? And I don't have any. It means either we're doing a good job and we're being very thorough, or they haven't really put a lot of thought into that and haven't generated any questions. So asking some of the same questions over and over should show whether we are growing as a group or growing as individuals in our knowledge and in our walk with Christ. So that's the purpose behind that, is to for you to continually probe what it is that people need to know to grow. The other preloading on the critique, meaning I can already hear this coming back on the critique responses, how to avoid the Sunday school answers. In other words, you ask a question that is so simple everybody knows it, and then you move on. One of the things, again, I would like to challenge is for you to push back as a facilitator and have people go deeper. Now, this is not your responsibility to have the knowledge to go deeper. The only thing that we ask facilitators to do is to ask questions that make people reflect beyond the Sunday school answer. So if your people aren't already doing that, I would encourage you to help them do that by just asking questions and then not letting them get away with the Sunday school answer. All right, another part of the lesson plan talks about compare and contrast the difference between Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector, and the unnamed woman that washes Jesus' feet with her tears. I don't want to do your homework for you, but I want to give you something to at least start on. This would be a great visual for either visual learners or people who learn by moving. If you have a piece of paper you can throw up on the wall, you can either use the butcher paper and easel, or here's a cool trick, but please make sure this doesn't bleed through on someone's wall. You can take a white trash bag, like a kitchen trash bag, and literally cut it right in half along the seams, and static electricity will make it stick to the wall. And then if you take a whiteboard marker, you can mark on that just like you would a whiteboard. And there's no tape put on the wall. You can actually sort of semi-erase it depending on the quality of the trash bag. And it makes a great instant whiteboard for next to no money at all. You might ask, how do you know that, Bill? Well, never mind. But it does work. But please make sure it doesn't bleed through on the wall, or I'll get lots of angry emails. All right. At any rate, I bring that up because a lot of times putting up a display and having people come up and write generates movement, generates excitement. People can see the responses. The responses can stay up there and help generate more ideas. That's all valuable in instructional technique. So let me run through a couple of things that you might want to dwell on if people come up a little short on the compare and contrast. When we're talking about Zacchaeus and the unnamed woman, they both represent outcasts in Jewish society, you know, clearly. They are both, however, engaged by Jesus when no one else would pay attention to them or approach them. So these are things that they have in common. The other thing I noticed between the two of them is that Jesus takes away time from something that is important business to spend with them. In the case of Zacchaeus, he's on his way to Jerusalem, and there's big important things going to be done there. He's going to save the world from her sins. Yet he takes a whole afternoon to spend with this guy who everybody despises. In the case of the Pharisee, the unnamed woman, Jesus has been invited to a Pharisee's house, a man of some import in the community, and chooses to stop and talk about her and talk with her, even with all that august company surrounding him. What do I learn from that? Maybe we need to reframe what we think is important. Maybe going on our way to that important business meeting isn't as important as that person we encounter. Or maybe that big important meeting, we meet someone that might be the most important thing on our agenda that day, if God puts it there. It's just about reframing what we think is important. The other thing that they both share in common is that they ultimately both receive a blessing from Jesus. And what makes that especially interesting to me is if you compare the words Jesus used in their case about their sins being forgiven and much happiness abounding and those kinds of things, then compare that to the words that he often says for the Pharisees, things like brood of vipers, whitewashed tombs, quite the contrast there. But these two outcasts share in receiving Jesus' blessing. All right, how about some contrast? And don't just stop there. There are other comparisons that you can do and elicit from people, but let's talk about some quick contrasts. Clearly, there is a gender difference. There is a man and a woman. But the cool thing in my mind about that is that it never mattered to Jesus. In fact, everywhere in Scripture that women encounter Jesus, their lot in life improves. And why I find that so ironic is that many people see today's Christianity as being oppressive to women. My recommendation is that they go back and not look at today's Christianity, but look at Christ himself and how he encountered and dealt with women. Very interesting to me, anyway. Might be a good sidebar discussion if you're short on time or if you have some extra time afterwards to chat about it. Another contrast. One of these characters was hated by everyone. The other was only hated by some. What do I mean by that? Everybody hates the tax collector. But for a prostitute to make a living, somebody had to provide business. So there were some in the community that, while they publicly said they didn't like her, were probably customers. A little bit of hypocrisy there, don't you think? Another contrast. Wealth. One was filthy rich as a tax collector. He was doing very well. The other was very poor, which makes her gift all the more valuable. But that's not why Jesus engages people. He doesn't engage based on the basis of whether they have a lot of money and can give back to the kingdom or not. I find that interesting today that we often think about sinners as being poor or underprivileged. But there's nothing poor about Zacchaeus. He is just as much in need of a savior and a change in lifestyle as much as the Enron executives were. Or people today like Bernie Madoff, who made off with millions and billions of dollars. It has nothing to do with socioeconomic status. It's the status of the spirit. And that's what Jesus always focuses on. It's never about money or assumptions of money. All right, so you can probably think of other things to compare and contrast, but I wanted to at least get you started and give you that recommendation to get people up and moving and looking at something visual. The other thing I want to delve into just a little bit is the risks that Jesus takes in encountering all these people. There are really, there are many reasons, but two I want to focus on. He risks his reputation, and he risks going up against the culture's understanding of clean versus unclean. So let me expound on that just a minute. He risks his reputation. Reputation was everything to a rabbi. That's how you attracted followers in that day. And followers paid the bills. Even more so, if you wanted to attract respectable followers from wealthy families, you certainly didn't hang around with the people that Jesus hung around with. It would damage his reputation. Clearly, that is not Jesus' concern. He has a higher agenda. But it does raise the question today, are we as a church, and I don't mean word surf, but I mean in the North American setting, are churches more concerned with our reputation than our calling? Interesting question, and you can probably think of some examples. The other thing that Jesus risks is very much in the culture of the day when it comes to clean versus unclean. And we have to understand that in their context. In the Jewish mindset, the essence of uncleanliness is opposition to God, and especially in regards to sexual sin. So you can see the problem that this, quote, immoral woman, unquote, causes when she enters into the Pharisee's home. And what about the tax collectors? Well, if they wouldn't be caught dead with people of Israel and they had no friends, how do you get friends if you have a lot of money? Well, you throw parties, and at the parties you have lots to drink, and maybe you invite some of these prostitutes, and everybody has a great time, and they like you as long as your money lasts. So both of them were contributing to the Pharisees' disdain for sexual sin and uncleanliness. But it goes further than even just a disdain for sexual activities outside of the law. It impacted the priests because if they were considered unclean, they could not enter the temple. If they could not enter the temple, they couldn't do their jobs. So they distanced themselves on purpose. Again, their motive might have been initially good. They wanted to be able to honor and serve God. How they go about it, though, caused some problems, especially for those people that they were trying to reach. So they also, if they ever encountered anybody who was considered unclean, if they touched a corpse especially, that was a big unclean activity. And they had to go through elaborate cleansing rituals and wait a prescribed period of time before they could perform priestly duties again. So that's one of the reasons that they were so adamant about avoiding these people. But Jesus begins to change all that. And he changes it in really two venues. What I would call natural uncleanliness and unnatural uncleanliness. Here's what I mean. Natural uncleanliness is when things happen. You're born deformed. You get a leprous condition, a skin condition. You have some other disease, not your fault, but it's a natural cause. Now, whereas a respectable Pharisee would never touch someone with a skin condition, because, again, unclean, Jesus does touch, even though he doesn't have to. This is what fascinates me. Jesus chooses to touch people with various conditions, even though he doesn't have to. If you want a great example of compare and contrast with this, read Matthew chapter 8. It opens with a leper asking for Jesus' mercy, and Jesus heals the leper by touching him. So, big no-no for the Jewish hierarchy of the day. And so we think, well, yeah, he had to touch him to heal him, right? Well, keep reading in Matthew 8, because the very next thing that happens is a centurion comes along and says, I have a servant that is sick. He's back home. And I don't want you to have to make yourself unclean by coming into my house. See, the centurion understood he was a Gentile and that Jesus coming into his house would make Jesus unclean. And what does Jesus do? He heals the servant from long distance. Jesus didn't have to touch anybody to heal them. Jesus chose to touch a leper There's a great discussion question. Why did he choose to touch when he didn't have to? Is he sending a message to the Pharisees? Is he reinforcing to that person that not only is he clean on a spiritual level, but he's loved on a physical level in a Platonic and Christian way? Who knows? I don't know the answer to that. It would make a great discussion question. So Jesus cleanses natural uncleanliness by healing and by touching in some cases. What about unnatural cleanliness? By this I mean people who choose to live in a moral lifestyle, whether it's the prostitute or the chief tax collector. How does Jesus deal with unnatural uncleanliness? Guess how he does it? Wait for it. Forgiveness. He forgives them. In essence, he's welcoming them, extending an invitation back into the family to belong again when no one else would. Now, the cool thing to me is that Jesus didn't just extend an invitation, he hand-delivered it. So when everybody else was grumbling about him spending all this time with tax collectors and sinners, he was actually hand-delivering an invitation to belong again. I think that's pretty cool. And the ultimate irony is, here you have the body of Pharisees shunning these women of immoral repute. But one of the things that you repeatedly see throughout the Old Testament, and especially throughout the prophets' writings in the Old Testaments, is God is railing against Israel because they're not keeping what God intended for them to keep. They're not taking care of the poor. They're not taking care of the widows and the orphans. They're not acting out their faith. And so there is, I guess, an argument to be made that if they had poor economic conditions and some of these women were not being taken care of because these guys were too busy, you know, doing whatever it is Pharisees do and not doing what they're supposed to do, if the Pharisees had taken care of them, would they have had to enter a life of prostitution? Sometimes that was the only way they could make a living. So I think that's why Jesus is so angry. In some cases, it's not only are they ignoring these people, but they may have contributed to creating the conditions that drove him to that decision in the first place. I don't know that that's true. That's my speculation. Take it for what it's worth. All right, later in the lesson, I ask for you all to capture some ideas, especially when it comes to the questions regarding who would be upset today if Jesus came and acted, and what hesitations do people have about approaching others and sharing what Jesus is doing in their lives. And the reason I ask is because this is all interrelated. We're not just doing community groups so that we know stuff. We're doing community groups so that we grow joyful servants of Jesus. And this feedback helps us determine what it is that we need to teach and preach and train for. And so a community group becomes equipping with a laser focus instead of just doing random stuff like a shotgun that sounds good. So it has a purpose and it's all tied together. It also helps us develop our leadership strategy for this transforming of communities one relationship at a time. So any time an organization goes out into a community without good intelligence, you're asking for failure. So we're asking for people's perspectives. What's out there that we might encounter as we begin to transform the community? What should we prepare for? What should we equip for? What should we train for? If we march blindly, we run the risk of turning into the next Custer. Personally, I don't want to be a part of WordServe's last stand. So please take the time to capture those ideas and relay them to me. And in true leadership fashion, you don't have to do this yourself. You can appoint a scribe to capture them, email them to me, or write them on the back of a napkin, however you get them to me. I'd be more than happy to take them. All right, one other thing I want to cover on the lesson is the idea that we might be able to get ahead of the need of forgiveness. And that question is reflected in what would you say to those people who are upset by Jesus' actions, even today? It's a good opportunity to review all the things we've been talking about in forgiveness, but it's also an opportunity to think about how we might communicate the truth in love in advance of doing something that might be offensive. If we do that well beforehand, there may not even be a need for forgiveness. So how do you speak the truth in love? That is way beyond the scope of the lesson, but if you're looking for something else to discuss, it's certainly an opportunity. And I imagine that at some point we will cover that in greater detail, but just wanted to let you know that nugget is out there. All right, that covers the administration, and that covers the lesson. I just want to end with a word of encouragement to you all. I wanted to just ask you to consider that the seeds that you're planting today may help your group members heal, and it may help not only your group, but it may help people you haven't even met or may never meet. You may help people in your group be free from years of being held captive by a lack of willingness to forgive on someone's part. So basically, you're on a mission to free prisoners and help them find not only life again, but life abundant. And you never know who you're impacting a world away or when it will happen. What you say in these activities or what the questions that you ask and people reflect on may happen years later. You just never know. And that's part of the exciting and frustrating part of facilitating. And it may even happen in your life as well. I know what you're thinking, all that just from getting together on a weeknight and just asking questions. Yeah, if the Spirit is in it, absolutely yes. So I pray constantly for y'all that the Spirit might live in you and through you, that you might experience the freedom of forgiveness, and that you might be really free. And I'll continue to pray for you. So keep up the good work, stay strong in Christ and not in yourself. Watch what happens when a people called Word Serve step into the light of freedom and invite others to do the same. Be blessed, and they be a blessing to others. We'll see you next time. Thanks again for all you do.